Well, thank you very much. It's a thrill to be here, Bainbridge. One interesting thing about writing a story about your life 30 years ago is you get to meet a bunch of old friends, and my old friends Art and David just showed up that I haven't seen in 30 years. That's a shocker. But to write this, I went back, and although this is the first 10 years of Greenpeace, which Greenpeace, as you may well know, it was started in Vancouver when the U.S. was attempting to test nuclear weapons in the Aleutian Islands, and that was sort of the original impetus to start an organization. And I can tell by the hair color a few of you were alive at that time, but. And as you know, I mean, there was a robust peace movement at the time, and there were a lot of Americans who went to Canada during the Vietnam War, and I was one of them. And in Vancouver at that time, there was a really interesting mix. And one of the things that conclusions I came to in reviewing that history and writing the book is I realized that throughout history. Where do new ideas come from? Where does cultural change ultimately come from? If you sort of dig back, one of the things I realize is that one place cultural change comes from is where the cultural norms, for one reason or another, get thrown out of kilter or mixed up. That as long as everybody's comfortable and going along, many good things happen. But one thing that doesn't tend to happen is you don't get cultural change. Or certainly you don't get quick cultural change. Cultures, of course, evolve. But what was happening in Vancouver at that time was, because of the influx of Americans, draft resistors, you had people coming across Canada from the East Coast, from Quebec and so forth, and there was a huge Chinese and Japanese culture in Vancouver, so there were Buddhists and Tibetans, and it was just a very eclectic culture. And Greenpeace and a lot of other things grew out of Vancouver at that time. I think we were most influenced by the Quakers. Greenpeace could have been like any other peace group, anti-war group. Could have done a few actions and disappeared and off the face of the earth. But I think one of the things that held it together was the influence of the Quakers and this sort of Quaker tolerance. The Quakers, I remember at the Quaker meetings, Quakers had a saying that I won't stand in your way, and what they mean by that is I don't agree with you on that, but I trust that you're sincere and you're not hurting anybody, and I would do it differently, and I think you should do it differently, but I'm not going to stand in your way. That was kind of this attitude of tolerance that I think is so healthy in a culture, and oftentimes we don't see enough of it, of course. And I think in our little culture of environmentalists and peace activists in Vancouver at that time, it was sort of that tradition of Quaker tolerance which held us together. Because I can assure you, there were many factions in Greenpeace in the early days, and there were a lot of people on the sort of peace side of Greenpeace, if you would say, who believed that we should continue to work for stopping nuclear weapon testing and stopping war, and were aghast of the idea that we would go out in boats to stop to save the whales. They thought that was frivolous and foolish when we first started doing that. And there were all these conflicts within Greenpeace at the time, and I think that this sort of Quaker tolerance was part of it. Plus, we borrowed a lot of our tactics from Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and the Quakers. And there had been boats that had gone into nuclear test zones before Greenpeace. There were a couple of Quaker boats, one called the Phoenix, one called the Everyman, that had sailed into nuclear test zones in the 50s. And so we kind of borrowed that tactic. And the one thing that I think Greenpeace brought to civic protests was that many of us were journalists, albeit young journalists and aspiring journalists. I was a photographer and a writer, and I wanted to be a journalist. That's what I wanted to do. And I found a job there at one of the community newspapers. And other people involved in Greenpeace in the early years, Bob Hunter was a journalist at the Vancouver Sun, columnist at the Vancouver Sun. Ben and Dorothy Metcalf were both journalists. And I think that we had this knowledge of how the media worked. And plus, we were all Marshall McLuhan fans. I don't know if you've read any of Marshall McLuhan. But Marshall McLuhan's theories and ideas that were quite the rage in the late 60s and early 70s, you know, since writing this book, I've sort of gone back to some of his ideas. And I realize how relevant they are still today for how we learn. And it was something that Greenpeace understood at that time because we were working journalists and because we'd read Marshall McLuhan. And one of the things that Marshall McLuhan said is that we don't learn from the facts and the statistics. We do once we're interested in a subject, and if we want to do our own research, we learn depth of a subject that way. But we don't really learn new things through the facts and statistics. We learn through stories and mythology, and we always have. Learning starts with emotion. And I think this is something even our school systems today, they don't realize, they don't accept and realize that you have to be, as we say, turned on to something, excited about it, emotionally involved in it, to learn it. And I see that with my kids all the time, that if I can't stimulate in my kids, in my children, an enthusiasm for a subject, it's a waste of time to try and drill it into their heads. But if I can find a way to, like, math is a typical thing. I mean, if I can find a way, to link it to something that they love doing, like keeping stats on their soccer games or how to cook a chocolate cake, then, okay, suddenly fractions start to make sense or percentages start to make sense, you know. You've won 67% of your games, you know. But learning starts with emotion, and this is something that Greenpeace understood. So when we went out on those boats to save the whales, and when we went into nuclear test zones, and we went to the east coast of Canada to save the seals, we knew that, or we felt, this is our theory at the time, was that the way we're going to change culture to care about the ecology, to care about the environment, is not present all the statistics, not present the facts, but to show images that people can emotionally connect with. And I think when people saw those images of those, when we went out to save the whales, the general image that people had of whaling was 18th, 19th century stuff of little brave men in boats, little boats and these huge leviathan. But that's not the way whaling at all was in the 20th century. It was huge metal boats with sonar and massive exploding harpoons, and those factory ships are like 10 stories tall, huge floating factories. And this was the reality of industrial whaling. So when we brought back these pictures of these whales, dead whales, dwarfed by these huge metal factory ships, it changed people's perception about what whaling was. And when people saw pictures of live whales and baby seals on the east coast of Canada getting clubbed at 3 days old and skinned on the ice, it changed people's perception. And then all the facts and the statistics and all the follow-up comes after that. But first people have to emotionally connect. And so that's really what Greenpeace was. It was, we took the Quaker nonviolence and tolerance, and we applied sort of modern media to it. One of the book reviewers in Australia, I think, summed it up perfectly. He says, Greenpeace was just Quakers with cameras. And how does all this apply today is one good question, one interesting question. Where are we today? And, you know, it's interesting for me going back, even though I lived through this, and going back and looking at where we were. In 1969, 70, when Greenpeace got started, most people didn't even know what ecology was. I swear, if you had gone to a college campus in 1969 and asked 100 students what ecology was, I don't think you would have gotten 4 or 5 credible answers, and no one knew. I remember as a college student having to look it up. What is that? And one of the early Greenpeace founders, Ben Metcalf, with his own money, it cost him $12,000, put up billboards all over Vancouver that said, ecology, look it up, you're involved. This was in 1969. Imagine, I mean, today, and everybody, today everybody knows what it is. And if you know, if you look at, so we've come a long way. I mean, that's the point. If you look at as many issues as we have to deal with in our culture today, which is huge, and especially if you look at the world in large, but in the last 50 years, I mean, since I've been alive and been aware of what's going on in the world, I grew up, for example, in a segregated town. I mean, maybe some of you did. I grew up in a town where the blacks went to one high school and the whites went to another high school, and the two cultures didn't intermingle. And I went to school in Midland, Texas, where your president, George Bush, went to school, by the way. Thing I say about... One thing that George Bush and I have in common is we're both draft dodgers. I didn't have the connection, see, so I had to go to Canada, or I should say got to go to Canada. I still live there. I'm thrilled living in Canada. So we've come a long way. If you look at the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the ecology movement, what has happened in our culture in the last 50 years, I think it's phenomenal. I mean, we grew up in when I was a kid, as I said, I grew up in a segregated town, and blacks did not have the same rights that we had, that whites had. Women did not have the same rights. When I look at young girls today, and they have all these visions of things that they want to do, and the freedom to do it, and I realize it's just amazing that when my sister was growing up, she didn't have that perception of the world, and certainly my mother didn't have that perception of the world. So these things have changed, and I think the thing that's to me that's important to realize is where those changes start. And if I look at the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, all the changes that have happened in our culture in the last 50 years, it all starts with citizens standing up. Doesn't start with the government, doesn't start with companies. The government and the companies, we may drag them along, but it starts with somebody says, it's like Rosa Parks on the bus, refusing to sit in the back of the bus. And who was Rosa Parks? And she was just a seamstress. She'd been working all day. She was tired. And she finally just stood her ground and said, no, I'm just sitting here and I'm not getting up. And you can credit her with a great deal of the momentum of the civil rights movement. And this is where change starts. So we've made all this progress, but when I look out on the world today, and especially because I've been traveling around and talking to people and reading newspapers and been, you know, since I've written the book about Greenpeace, I've been more engaged in what's going on in the world today, and I have to say, it's frightening. It's scary what's going on. It's not just the United States flexing their muscles all over the world and going into Iraq for the oil and beating up on those poor people there. And now I'm noticing now on the television all this talk about Iran that's sort of creeping in. I'll tell you, it scares me, because I know they'd love to go into Iran too and take the oil there, because who's in Iran? China. China's in Iran cutting deals with the Iranians. And what kind of deals are they making with uraniums? Nuclear power, nuclear weapon technology? I'm sure everything's on the table. I mean, in some ways, our world is run by thugs. And it's not just the Americans. It's not just the Bush gang. I mean, you know, so it really comes down to us, the citizens, to make a stand on these issues. And... As much progress as we've made in the environmental issues, the environmental catastrophes are most of what has driven the environmental catastrophes that we experienced in the 50s and 60s and 70s that really led to the environmental movement of the 70s and 80s was driven by the lifestyle of about 15% of humanity, us. The wealthy West, our lifestyle. The rest of the world would like to live like we do. They'd like to have three meals a day, hot baths, cars, travel, comfortable homes, And the momentum of those countries, just take China and India, for example, and as well as Africa, the momentum in China alone to provide our lifestyle for the Chinese people. The Chinese government has 110 coal-fired power plants on the drawing boards planned for the next 20 years in China. Those new 110 coal-fired power plants in China will more than five times erase any effect of Kyoto, even if we all sign it and agree on it and do it, which isn't going to happen, by the way. And much thanks to the United States, of course, for that. And I'm sure you all know this. I mean, the environmentally conscious around the world are really miffed that the United States hasn't signed this. But you're not alone. But it's a serious problem. But when you look at even if we did all sign and keep to Kyoto, what's planned in China is going to erase any advantage by five times, and that's just the power plants in China burning coal. And they have plans for 60 million new cars in China, and they're already using 50% of the cement in the world, and they're using like 25% of the copper in the world, and they're using like 30% of the steel in the world, and they're trying to crank up. And who are we to say they shouldn't do it? We're all living this way. And so when I look at there's a bit more about the China's trying to buy up. Well, first of all, they're going into places like Iran, the same way the United States is going into Iraq. China's into Iran trying to cut deals with the Iranians. But they're in Canada trying to buy up any resource company they can buy in Canada. They're buying up logging companies and mining companies all over the world. And they don't necessarily have any environmental scruples. And you see our North American corporations have exported a lot of the worst environmental crimes. I mean, I know there's a huge issue in Indonesia right now about the mining and dumping the they just run the mine tailings right out into the bays in these big huge pipes, and there was no way off Bainbridge Island they'd be allowed to do that. But they can own a company in Indonesia that does it, and they just send it out in pipes into the middle of the bay. Cesium, arsenic, into the bay. And then, the people are coming down. Gee, there's a cancer epidemic, So now there's this big battle in places like Indonesia and the Philippines over these mining issues and things that we would not tolerate here. So when I look at all that at the world level, I think the environmental crisis and the environmental movement and what is going to be required is just beginning for the world. And my worst fears are that the war in Iraq is just the tip of the iceberg, and that we're going to have Russia and China and India and the United States and all the big powers are going to be battling for the last tree and for the last bay and for the last copper mine. And in many ways, it's like we've made a lot of progress, and I think that, but on the other hand, all of this stuff can be rolled back, and often is rolled back. All the progress we've made can be rolled back in an instant like that, and we have to be prepared. And I think we also have to use our progress, the freedom, and the consciousness and the awareness that we have in North America to help and support and further these movements elsewhere in the world. I think in many ways we owe it to the world, not just morally. I mean, I know that we can sympathize and we can have compassion for the world, and that's just a natural instinct to have compassion for the rest of the world. But I think we have a debt as well. Like our culture has scoured the world for resources, and we've created a very comfortable culture for ourselves. And I think that we need to embrace the challenges that the world's going to face as the rest of the world goes after those dwindling and fast disappearing same resources. And of course, we all know in the meantime we're cooking the planet by burning all these fossil fuels and so forth. So I look at that and I go, well, gee, with all this progress, in many ways, it's very much like the 1950s. There's a very conservative movement in the world politically, not just in the United States, everywhere. So we've got a lot to overcome. One of the things that inspires me sometimes is a comment that Mae Sarton made. She said, to be an ordinary, decent human being, you have to think like a hero. And I think that that's very important. And really, when we started Greenpeace in the early 70s, we didn't think we were heroes. We just were looking at the world going, my God, I mean, this is just obvious what we should do. There used to be slavery in the United States. I mean, it seems obvious to us now that that's not okay, that's not morally okay. But just to do the right thing, you have to act like a hero. And so each of us in our own way, in our own communities, I think that's something to keep in mind. We do have to stand up. I mean, you never know where you're going to come face to face with injustice. You never know. It might be in your school. It might be bullies in your school. Who knows? Bullies in the neighborhood. And I've seen so many cases where, you know, we try not to rock the boat. We don't want to make anybody feel uncomfortable. But there was a case in Canada, on the prairies in Canada, where a girl claimed she was raped. And that was everyone in the town said, no, she wasn't raped. And she said she was raped by this hockey team. And a junior hockey team. And everybody says, well, no, it was a party and it was consensual and yada yada. Anyway, this journalist came out to Saskatchewan and she interviewed everybody and everybody says, no, it was a consensual thing. It was something that happens. And she talked to the coach. She talked to the girls' counselor at the school. She talked to everybody in the town. No. Well, her report, which ended up on television in Canada, stimulated further research. Eventually, after 5 years of research, they laid 360 sexual abuse charges in this one small town in Saskatchewan. Now, how do you have 360 sexual abuse charges in a small town and nobody knows about it? I don't think so. What you have is people turning their heads, not wanting to get involved, not wanting to rock the boat. And you had systemic abuse, you know, by coaches, some of the abusers were in the police department. The counselor at the school turns out to be the wife of the guy who owned the hockey team. Anyway, the point is, my friends, I think that in our communities, we have to be careful not to turn our heads. We had a case in my community where we had this soccer coach who was just inappropriate with the kids. Not sexually, but just inappropriate. Violent language, cursing, swearing, making kids cry. I remember standing up at the soccer club meetings, you know, to address this, and feeling the resistance, and feeling like, you know, don't do this, don't rock the boat, don't bring this into your community. I'm thinking, I'm not bringing this into my community. I just noticed this. And I think that we all ought to just be aware and open our eyes and not turn our heads. And I think in our communities, wherever it comes up, but also in the world at large, that it's our responsibility. Anyway, Fred Douglas, who some of you may know about Fred Douglas, he was born a slave and became a chief justice in the United States. He says, if you find out what people will submit to, you found out the exact amount of injustice that will be imposed on them. And I think he's right. If you find out what people will submit to, you have found out the exact amount of injustice that will be imposed upon them. And so it's up to us not to submit. At a certain point, we have to say no. And it's not just a matter we know of going to the polls every 4 years and casting a vote. I mean, democracy is in action. And if we don't exercise those democratic rights, we will lose them. And, someone, when I was on my tour, someone asked me, one of the interviewers asked me, what would I be willing to die for? Okay, well, that's a good question. I thought about that. It's a short list, I told her. You know, I mean, I might risk death, you know, if I felt my family was threatened or something. But as a tactic, I don't really want to die as a tactic. You know, I want to live for the things I believe in. But I think that if we don't act every day and be prepared to act and keep our eyes open and be prepared to speak up even at the smallest injustice, I think that ultimately it gets to the point somebody will have to die for these rights because we didn't live for them. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. Anyway, I'm just about through and I'm going to ask you. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.